add my recommendation and welcome for you to come to the seminar on Friday night. That's a great opportunity for us. I was a few months ago, a few chapters into reading James Thompson's book when Pat suggested, well, I know he's going to be in town this weekend. Why don't we see if he would stay over and speak with us on Friday night? And I thought, oh, what a great opportunity because I was really enjoying the book. And I don't know about you, but I like to hear a person if I can, hear their voice in my mind while I'm reading a book. So I kind of put that one away for right now. I'm looking forward to Friday night and then picking that book back up and reading it and hearing him talk about it. It's extremely insightful. If you want to get into the mind of Paul, that's what we've been trying to do here in Philippians, then this is an occasion that you won't have another occasion like. You'll be hearing from a true scholar of Paul, a person who's just marinated themselves in the Apostle Paul and his writings. So, Friday night, 7 o'clock, right here. Hope you'll be here. Also, today, looks like we made a good decision. There's sun shining outside. Made a good decision to postpone Serve the City Day last week. It did rain all day last Sunday, so since a lot of our activities have to do with the outdoors, this is going to be a good day to do it. You'll be nice and cool. You probably won't even sweat. Okay, so there is a lunch prepared by the Energizers. It's a working lunch for those who are going to be participating in Serve the City Day today. Really appreciate our Energizers group. They got in here early this morning and got all that ready. So we thank them for their service today. They've already begun serving here, serving this church family, serving those in our community around us. I'll let you know this. Once we have the benediction here, Susie's going to lead a benediction at the close of our service. And if you'll just go on to the fellowship hall, if you're participating in Serve the City Day, if you haven't signed up for a job, you can stop at the table right out there and look. Paul might be standing there. Nick, if you'll be standing there too and kind of be looking where people could go and serve today. So you can put your name down on that. And then go on in and everything's been blessed. Go on in and go ahead and eat because we're going to move on today. This day is about, the lunch is about energizing us to serve. So get on in there and eat. If you will, you'll notice that at each table they're designated for the different areas of service. Go ahead and sit with the table of the area of service that you're going to be participating in today. And you guys can start to get organized there. At the table there will be an address for where you'll be going. You can talk about the tools that you have, if somebody needs to help transport tools and that kind of thing. Also, if you're working at Freedom Middle School, there are actually parents and students from the school who are going to be meeting us there today. We'll be working alongside them, which is a wonderful opportunity as well. And since they are meeting us, and it's kind of on a time deadline, I both have to preach fast, and I would like for you to go on kind of to the first of the line there. If you would go on, please don't linger around here. We don't want to be dragging that out. We need to get over there and get teamed up with that crew. So it's going to be a really a great day. Again, thanks to everyone who's worked to prepare this, Paul and Nick, and for the Energizers for our luncheon. And it's going to be a fantastic time. So back to Philippians and Paul. We've only got a couple of more weeks here in Philippians. I hope that you've gained as much by kind of this window into Paul's mind. I think it's a wonderful book. It's a book of great beauty, of striking statements. This passage that we're looking at today is a very memorable passage. If you are have been around church for very long and heard the Bible read very, very many times in your life, you've probably heard this passage. It's a favorite. It's one because of its cadence. There's kind of a rhythm to it. And because it has such practical sounding and practical statements, it's one that a lot of Sunday school teachers will assign to their students to have memorized. It's the kind of thing that you want to be down deep inside of you so that it comes forth, you know, in that moment when you're ready to apply it. So Paul had been, just in two previous verses before this, talking about the things that had to do with inside the church matters, with those two women, Euodia and Syntyche, and whatever conflict that they had. And now with these verses, he moves outside of the church. Kind of like what we're doing today. He's looking outside of the walls of the church, outside of just our relationships, and thinking about how we interact with people out there in the world. Now, Paul, I think, would like that we were you know, thinking about that today, and he would like probably the fact that many of you have got this memorized, because he intended for this book, this letter of the Philippians, to be read, just like most of his letters, he intended for them to be read aloud in the church. He intended for one person to get up and read these verses, read this whole book to the church there in Philippi. In that day, one person, who they would call a lector, would get up and read that letter to everybody. Now, that wasn't a technique that Paul invented, that he just had this great idea. Hey, I think I'll just get one guy to do this. No, this was very much a reflection of the culture. This was the days, of course, before the printing press. You didn't have mass distribution of texts. And for that matter, most people couldn't read. So you needed somebody who was trained to read, to be able to communicate these things. And also, typically here, a writer who wanted a message to be read to a group would prepare the reader to read their message. So that would go beyond just then merely reading the letter or reading the message. They would be prepared to bring out the nuances, the subtleties of the text. They could emphasize a particular point. They could deliver a line with the proper emotion. They could paraphrase a section that wasn't clear. They could correct the audience if they misunderstood the author's intent. So it was a back and forth kind of process. They were reading, and they knew the author's intent, and they were also trying to get feedback from the listeners so that they could make sure that they're communicating correctly. Now, knowing that this letter was designed to be read aloud to a gathered church, might make us reflect a little bit differently when Paul says, rejoice. What does he mean by rejoice? So it's to a gathered church. And when it's spoken like that to a gathering of Christians, he's probably not just talking about, or primarily talking about, some kind of inner individualistic reflection. He's talking about a corporate experience of rejoicing. He's saying, rejoice together. He really means something probably more like celebrate. Celebrate. Raise the roof. Whoop it up right now, right? Feel something together. Okay, there you go. The way that you celebrate when you get an A on that test that you've worked really hard for. The way you celebrate when you get that big promotion at work. The way you celebrate when you find out whether your new grandbaby is a boy or a girl, or if none of those things interest you, the way you celebrate when your favorite team scores a touchdown, that's celebrating. We celebrate together. Celebration, rejoicing in a group is meant to be, rejoicing is meant to be done together. This is the kind of joy that we're experiencing here. When we rejoice in the Lord, we're rejoicing about the Lord and what the Lord has done, but we're also rejoicing with the Lord. We're joining a celebration that's already in progress. Now, the Greeks and the Romans, they had their festivals and they had their games. So they had their celebrations too. And Paul's saying, you know, Christians, we really have something to celebrate. Jesus' first miracle was at a party. And he was responsible for bringing the wine. And he brought lots of it. It's about a celebration. When we celebrate, we realize it's made so real to us that the Lord is near. Near because we know Christ is coming back one day to set all those crooked ways straight. And for sure, even 2,000 years from that moment, we know today we're one day closer to whenever that is. Today is closer than yesterday to that time. We're also nearer now because Christ, even now, is present with us. Jesus promised to never leave us and to never disown us. And when we take communion together, when we come around this table together, it's a symbol that Christ is here. We eat this meal together, and I know it's tiny, but don't forget how powerful it is, the truths that it tells. We come around this table and we experience and we proclaim ourselves to be a family of God. We proclaim that Christ is at the head of this table, serving us. We proclaim we are God's family. So Christ is present. Christ is present with us in our lives. And I know that's something that you have to experience to know it down deep. But when you do know it, When you know the Lord is near, then you also know that you have to treat others with gentleness as Christians. That guy who makes you mad at work is also God's creation. That woman who thinks she's so much better than you, she's a child of God, whether she knows it or not. Jesus' ability to love those who would be his enemies came from this understanding that those people were God's wandering children. And he told them that God was like a father waiting every day for even one of his children to come to their senses and come home. Now, maybe treating those kinds of folks, being gentle instead of being angry, instead of choosing hatred, instead of choosing to fight back, maybe treating folks like that will bring them to their senses, or maybe not. To a Christian, does that matter? Does that determine our response? How can you harm your brother, even if they didn't realize they were your brother? How could you wish anything but good on your sister? So Paul says Christians need to replace anger and hatred with gentleness. He also says Christians need to replace anxiety with prayer. Anxiety can have a biological basis like depression sometimes does. And if you continually struggle with anxiety, you need to check it out with a counselor or with a doctor. But sometimes anxiety is caused by other factors like past trauma in your life or like misplaced priorities. I wonder sometimes whether the Apostle Paul didn't struggle with anxiety himself. He often expressed his worry for his friends. In this book of Philippians, he expresses his worry for them. He actually wrote in one place, in another letter, "I have anxiety for all the churches that I've planted." So maybe Paul was sensitized to the negative ways anxiety can work in our lives. The way that it feels when you feel like you're just spinning in circles and you're really never getting any traction. You're never going anywhere. And in those times, anxiety can seem like it's taken over your life, like you can't stop it. Now, if you've ever been seasick, you know what it's like to be crippled by anxiety. That's something that you just, once you start experiencing it, it's so hard to stop. Seasickness develops because when you're in a rocking boat, you have the tendency to either focus on those things that are right around you, nearest to you, or you try to close your eyes and just shut out all the external stimulation. The problem is both of those things make it worse. The best way to prevent seasickness is to keep your eyes focused in the distance on the horizon, on something that's not moving. And then your brain can adjust to all the motion that's going on around you. Some forms of anxiety, I think, might be dealt with in the same way. You can look to God, who is the only unmoving thing in that we experience, and adjust to the disorientation that's caused by all these things around us in life that just seem to be constantly in motion. We can't pin them down, but we can look to God. Prayer is the primary way Christians are taught to look at God. Prayer is so much more, or should be so much more, than making out a shopping list for God. When we reduce prayer to that, we've totally missed what prayer is. We do not have to be tossed around by a world in turmoil. No matter what our external circumstances might be, internally, we can be focused on God through prayer. Then what we need to be and what we will be is oriented to what is unmoving. When we focus our vision and recognize the Lord is near, it changes your perception. The world may be rocking and rolling, but you can have peace in the storm. I love the story of how Jackie Robinson became the first black player in Major League Baseball. That was in 1947. Some of you may have watched the movie. And of course, he was signed and played with the Brooklyn Dodgers. There's something that's not really captured in the movie, but is a story that happened with this. The baseball executive who signed Jackie Robinson was Branch Rickey. And he was a very devout Christian. One day, the story goes, he barged into his pastor's office while the minister was trying to study and said, "Don't let me interrupt you. I just want to be here. Do you mind?" It seems like he did that backwards. Should have said, "Do you mind?" first. Well, his minister said, "No, I don't mind." And so he continued his work. Well, so what Ricky did was he began to pace in the minister's office. And he paced back and forth across the minister's office. And every once in a while he would stop and he would look out the guy's window. And then he would start pacing again, pacing and stopping, pacing and stopping. And the guy said it lasted for 45 minutes. He said, finally, it's like all of a sudden, Ricky stopped, banged his fist down on the pastor's desk. "Please do not do this to me. I will not react well." And he said, "I've got it." And the pastor said, "What do you have, Branch?" And he said, Ricky sat down in a chair and he said, "This decision that I was trying to make was so complex. It was filled with so many pitfalls, but it was also filled with so much good. I knew that if it was right, I just had to pray to God about it and be sure that it's what God wanted me to do. And I am sure I've decided I'm going to sign Jackie Robinson." And so he went out and he did. He got up, he put on his hat, and he went out the door. And he changed, baseball or sports. He really changed and altered our culture by that decision. After he had signed Robinson, Branch Rickey got a lot of flack for that. And before Robinson ever played, one day a reporter in a little media session was interviewing him. And the reporter says, "You know what? That day that you put Robinson on the field, all hell is going to break loose." And Branch Rickey said, "I believe on that day all heaven will rejoice." Well, that's someone who's prayed and who has gained a perspective on what doesn't move. And they can be sure in the storm. I don't think it was by chance that Jackie Robinson was Branch Rickey's selection to do that. Jackie Robinson was also a very devout Christian. And so I think Ricky understood that the strength and the peace that comes in the middle of the storm is there for the follower of Christ. And that person in Jackie Robinson's place was going to need that too. This realization that the Lord is near helps us replace hatred and anger with gentleness. It helps us replace anxiety with prayer. And then also I think that this passage, it lets us know that it helps us replace bad examples with good examples of Christian living. We need to choose good examples of what life in Christ is supposed to look like. Those last two verses, 8 and 9 in this passage, are almost poetry. "Whatever is noble, whatever's right, whatever's pure, whatever's lovely, whatever's admirable, anything excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Whatever you've learned or perceived or received or heard or seen in me, put into practice." Verse 8 would have been familiar to the Philippians. That's a list of well-known virtues and values of that day. The Greeks and the Romans lauded the virtues of nobility, of purity, of loveliness, of excellence. They're all, you know, well-known cultural ideals of the good life. It kind of seems a little strange that Paul would list them, these virtues, and start to promote these virtues, doesn't it? Remember that he's writing to a church that's almost entirely made up of Gentiles, maybe entirely made up of Gentiles. And these people would have been brought up with this set of values from childhood. Now they've come to Christ. And they've come to a very different set of values in many ways. The virtue that Paul highlights most of all in this letter to the Philippians is humility. And humility in that culture was a curse word. Nobody wanted to be humble. Every time Paul held up the mind of Christ, a humble placing of your own needs below the needs of other people, he was going against the grain of that culture. Now, maybe these Christians in Philippi have become so countercultural that they've begun to reject all the ethics and values of their surrounding culture. And it's really easy to understand how that can happen. That culture that they were immersed in was constantly making their lives miserable. It would have been very tempting to say, there's nothing good about that. Maybe that's another reason why Paul has to remind them to let their gentleness be made known to everyone. Let that be your dominant trait to everyone out there. For us today, I think this is a reminder that no matter how much we disagree with others in our culture, we need to be gentle. We need to be loving. Some Christians today seem to take delight in provoking or insulting other people that they don't agree with. And when they do that, they are not acting like Christ. Make no mistake. When Paul comes back and says, think on these virtues, what's he saying? Maybe it's his way of saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, you can pay so much attention to all the ways that people within the church are different from people outside the church that you can forget all the things that we have in common, including an appreciation at certain times for certain values, and most of all, our common humanity as God's creation. We need to balance evidencing with our lives the unique vision of Christ for human life, while also accepting others and communicating our acceptance of others and love for others and the values that are good that they exhibit. All of those things, those values within them, are threads of God's creation running through their lives. The reason we want to tell others about Christ in the first place and the life God would have us live in this world is because we love and value those people, right? They are people God loves and values. Wouldn't it be more winsome and more true to delight in what we find, what we recognize in others that's good, than to try to widen the gulf between us? This has always been a tension in Christianity. At the times, the need to stand apart and to show differences, and at other times, to show commonalities. So I think within all of that, wherever we are in that tension, we need to be showing love and gentleness. Now, verse 9, kind of look at the end of this. Verse 9 acknowledges, in the way he constructs this, our need to balance these two things. The good things that we find in the larger human society around us with the task that we have as citizens of another human community that's springing up within it. He says, if I could paraphrase a bit, when it comes to nobility, purity, excellence, think about those things. But when it comes to the values and ways of life you've seen me practice, that you've seen other committed followers of Christ practice those things. There's a difference between thinking about something and practicing it. There's a certain level of commitment that goes with both. Now, before you say, Paul must really think he's all that to offer himself as an example for the Philippians, it doesn't seem very humble, and that's what the quality that you've been holding up, to keep saying, look at me and follow me. Well, first stop and realize these people that he's talking to didn't grow up with Christian parents. They didn't grow up going to Sunday school classes with Christian teachers. They didn't have four written accounts of the life of Christ like we do. They didn't have a book of history of those first followers of Jesus like we do in Acts. They didn't probably have any other letters like the many letters that we have in the New Testament illustrating what Christ's mind looks like when it's played out in the real world, except maybe the ones that Paul has written them. They had so much less than we do in so many ways. And yet they were the island that grew up in the middle of the ocean. They were the plant that grew in the middle of the forest there and grew strong, and we're heirs to them and to their faith. If you were lost in a jungle. You're hacking around for weeks through the vines and the branches there, and you're unable to tell where the sun is in the sky. You can't orient yourself which way is north, which way is south. You're dodging critters like spiders and snakes. Maybe you're on the verge of starvation. Now, if you were in that situation and somebody found you, you were lost and they found you, and you look at them and they're healthy, they've got the health that you want to have. They're happy. They've got the joy that you want to have. They look well fed. They look like they're nourished. And they say, I know the way out of here. Come with me. Would you say, that's really arrogant of you? Of course not. And if you were the God that found someone like that, you found someone lost and dying, would you think, well, I don't want them to think I'm being presumptuous here, so I'll just go about my way. No. And that's why Paul is jumping up and down and saying, over here, look at me, follow me. I know the way home here. I know the way home. Paul is trying to be a good guide. And his guidance in this passage is still very good. Replace the bad examples you've seen of human life with good examples based on Christ. Replace anxiety in your life with prayer. And replace anger and hatred with gentleness. If you want to have peace, then come to the God of peace. And He'll show you how to do those things. If you want to have peace this morning, we invite you to come to the God of peace. Come this morning as we stand and sing.